It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk to a researcher about English language learners in public schools and what happens when they are or aren't reclassified as proficient in English soon enough.
But first, when a veteran dies or is killed in combat, the veteran's next of kin usually claims their remains. But some veterans' remains are never claimed, leaving them unburied.
But a bill approved by the Wisconsin legislature would allow veterans groups to claim remains and finally lay them to rest with military honors. That bill now awaits Governor Walker's signature. David Kurtz is the American Legion State Adjutant in Wisconsin, and he joins us now to talk about this bill. David, welcome to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon. It's nice to be with you.
Well, how did this bill get its start?
Well, this started last year when one of our members out of Appleton, he had made a volunteer project of identifying the final resting place of every Wisconsin service member killed during the Vietnam War. So he was identifying everyone who was from Wisconsin killed in Vietnam and then identifying their grave sites. And when he found Terrence Sund, S-U-N-D. Terrence was killed in Vietnam searching a tunnel. And he, as it turns out, Mr. Sund was never interred. His remains wound up in a limbo, just in a state of limbo, at a cemetery down in the Milwaukee area.
And he, it turns out, is not unique. There are other remains like this. Do you have a sense of how widespread this issue could be in Wisconsin and maybe beyond?
Well, it's really hard to gauge. I can tell you that the outreach that our organization has done in conjunction with the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, the outreach we've done since last summer has turned up 45 different veterans across the state, from Eau Claire to the metro Milwaukee area to, you know, all across the state, and some going back as long as 50 years.
And are these remains that you have located, they're not just in Wisconsin, it sounds like. They're Wisconsin citizens who may have wound up elsewhere.
Well, the only ones we're aware of are here in Wisconsin. You know, we have limited resources. We're a volunteer organization, and all the programs that we have, ranging from our baseball program, Badger Boys State, Badger Girls State, it's all volunteer-driven. Nationally, I know that there is an organization that's called Missing in America Project, and they have made a number of years reaching out and looking with funeral service providers and cemeteries to identify veterans, specifically veterans in this state. But I can tell you that it's not just veterans. There are a number of people who are wind up in this kind of situation once they pass away.
And how did veterans groups go about pursuing this?
Well, our volunteers, we worked, again, with Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, but we would, our volunteers do a lot of stuff in towns all across Wisconsin. We've got over 500 local American Legion posts, and they perform funeral honors. When a veteran passes away, they are entitled to certain benefits from the federal government, but one of the things that our volunteers do, an honor guard will go to the gravesite, they will fire a funeral volley over the grave and assist in presenting the flag to the next of kin, the widow, the widower, the grandchildren. So as a result, a lot of our Legion members in towns across Wisconsin are very familiar with the funeral service providers, the funeral homes, because they see these folks on a weekly basis. And it becomes a simple question of, do you have any unclaimed remains in your at your facility?
And could you tell us a little more about the response from the funeral homes who might be housing some of these remains? Why have they been reluctant to simply bury the remains on their own?
Well, if you might imagine, it's a delicate situation. First of all, there are privacy concerns. You want to be respectful of someone who has passed away. But yet, at the same time, in this day and age, and the litigious nature of our society, let's say grandpa or grandma is a veteran, passes away in some town here in Wisconsin, and the funeral service providers kind of in a hard spot, then they go ahead and they do what they believe to be the right thing. They inter the remains. They bury them, or they, you know, give them to the state veterans cemetery or somewhere. And 3 months, 6 months, a year later, Cousin Vinny or, you know, Aunt Carol or someone in Arizona, Florida, or Texas pops up all of a sudden and say, well, what did you do with Grandpa? And they tell them, well, we did what we thought was the right thing, and we, you know, had a ceremony, and the next of kin would potentially raise all sorts of objections to the actions taken. So that's why, you know, people are reluctant to take on that potential liability, and that's really what this legislation does.
And so, tell us now what kind of allowances this makes for this kind of scenario.
Well, what this allows under state law, then, and I can safely assume Governor Walker is going to sign this into law, after 90 days, if these remains are unclaimed for a veteran, if a veteran is, it can be established that the veteran has honorable military service that affords them the benefit of being interred in a state veteran cemetery, after 90 days, if no next of kin claims the remains, the funeral service provider can then turn them over to the state, and the state would then proceed with interring the remains in a state veteran cemetery.
And how soon after the bill is signed into law do you think that veterans groups will be able to start providing burials?
I would think right on the heels of it. As I say, we've identified 45 remains across the state right now, and a number of them have verified military service that qualifies them for interment.
Have you heard from funeral homes and from families about how they feel about this bill and how it might change things for them?
Well, I can tell you from families, the families, because these are in a situation of no next of kin, we're really not finding a lot of families. There are, in some cases, distant relatives or other relatives who have been alerted and have taken action on their own once they've realized what the situation is. But these, in general, these, we're not talking about close relatives. We're talking about, you know, second cousins or, you know, extended family. The vast majority of these folks are people that died without children or with estranged from their family somehow. So we don't hear from family members. What we do hear from the funeral service providers is they're relieved that this is going to become available.
Now, as we know, funerals can be expensive. How will this new effort be financed?
Well, when we're talking about a federal benefit, you know, a veteran has, and anyone who served honorably on active duty for a period of time, especially during time of conflict, the federal government will pick up the cost. This is something that veterans earned as a result of our service. So there is, for the state of Wisconsin, veteran cemeteries, it is a net benefit to the state.
And you said these are often, the families involved here are distant relatives. They may not have been close with the deceased, but what does this mean in terms of a veterans group on a personal level?
Well, for us, I can tell you that veterans, people who have served in the military, we have a close connection to those who we serve with directly, but also by extension, you know, people in the same branch of service or who have that shared experience. For a young person to go into the service and serve, and it is something that marks them for life. That, you know, it's something that they always hearken back upon, the shared experience, the shared hardship. People who have been in that situation have put their life at risk. They have a very strong bond between fellow service members, and to think, let's face it, in a combat situation, it's chance circumstance. People lose their lives, and a lot of folks feel like, well, it could have been me. But yet, you know, people come out of these situations and they survive to old age. But they never forget that circumstance. They never forget those situations. So to find out that a fellow veteran is in limbo like this, you're really trained in the military not to leave your fellow soldiers behind. You don't abandon your fellow soldier. And so to think that someone who served honorably in this country is left in limbo like that, when they have earned the right to be buried in a veteran cemetery, This brings a great deal of comfort and closure to people who have served to know that that commitment is going to be fulfilled. It's frankly, it's a little shocking and distressing to think that someone, especially like Terrence Sund, who served in Vietnam, died in Vietnam, and was never properly buried for almost 50 years, that just doesn't it doesn't stand to reason. Why and how circumstances like that exist.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
David Kurtz is the American Legion State Adjutant in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about a new bill approved in the state legislature that would allow veterans groups to bury the unclaimed remains of veterans.
Both in Wisconsin and nationally, there's an academic achievement gap between ELL students, those are English language learners, and the rest of the student body. 5% of all students in Wisconsin public schools are considered ELLs, and they have a range of backgrounds, from refugees to young children of immigrants.
One of the main goals for students in ELL programs is to pass a standardized test that reclassifies them as English language proficient. When high school ELL students pass the test and enter classes with the rest of their peers, they could have access to coursework that could better prepare them for the ACT or college. But sometimes tests don't reflect how well a student speaks English, and some students are held back in their ELL program.
Jared Knowles joins us now. He studied data on ELL students in Wisconsin and what happens to them when they are or aren't reclassified as English proficient. He's also a research analyst with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Jared, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Judith. Thanks, Veronica, for having me today.
So let's start out. Who is considered an English language learner?
To be considered an English language learner, a student will be identified by the staff as possibly an English language learner and then given a screening exam to determine what their level of knowledge of English is. And then through that process, the school works with the student and their family to figure out where they fall and then gives them a standardized assessment called the Access Exam for ELLs, which was developed here in Wisconsin. And then that assessment really rates how close they are to becoming proficient at English.
So does that mean then that students who are identified as being ELLs, English language learners, that they are in completely separate classes from fluent English speakers?
That's a great question. It really depends on both how far they are away from English proficiency, and it also depends on the size of the school and the number of students that the school may have who are ELL students, whether they have the economies of scale to support a different instructional environment. The state of Wisconsin gives schools a lot of flexibility in the way they organize to deliver extra English as a second language instruction to those students, so it really does vary across the state, and that is actually something that sets Wisconsin and the upper Midwest apart from the states where most of the research on ELLs is typically done, Texas, California, and Florida.
As someone who has studied other languages and has lived in places where I was not speaking the native language very well, I know that when you're kind of segregated and around people who maybe are speaking your native language more, you don't necessarily achieve or take in that language that you're trying to learn quite as well.
Yeah, with children, there's a host of delivery models that are available to them, ranging from total immersion in English to a variety of supports in both English and in their native language. And it's really up to the experts in each school to kind of think about each child and the resources the school has available and try to find that happy balance between continuing to progress on the content so that they, when they become English proficient, they're not behind their peers in terms of their mathematics, their mm-hmm. social studies, their art, their history, but also getting them up to that mastery of the English language that's necessary.
Does it also vary depending on the age of the student? Because it certainly seems like a really young school-age child, first of all, they just kind of absorb language like nothing, but also they're not doing kind of that really hardcore academic work that, say, a high school student coming in is.
Yes, and that's some of the things that we look at and keep a close eye on is, you know, when you're younger, should the students and the school be prioritizing English content or should they be prioritizing substantive content? And that's it varies a lot by the age of the student and by the student's previous schooling. So one of the things that I try to remind people is the students in Wisconsin speak over 120 different languages. And so they have come from countries and backgrounds where they have a variety of previous experiences with school or no previous experience with school. And so the school really has to take that on a case-by-case basis.
So students get tracked into being an English language learner and hopefully they're developing their English language skills. At what point are they able to be reclassified as being proficient in English? What has to happen to trigger that?
Yeah, to trigger reclassification, there's a couple of criteria. The automatic reclassification can occur if a student meets a certain overall proficiency score on the ACCESS exam, which tests the student's ability not just to read and write English, but to speak English, to hear English, to comprehend English being spoken. Or a student can have a slightly lower score but have mastered English literacy, and that's reading primarily. And then they can be reclassified as well. Additionally, a school may choose to override the automatic reclassification if they have substantial other evidence that the student, maybe they didn't take the test that well that day, but they know that the student is actually proficient in English. And so the school can petition to override that and reclassify the student as a formerly English learning student.
And so is that what's referred to as a manual override?
Correct. Then? That's a manual reclassification.
And how often do those manual overrides happen or requests for a manual override?
They're very infrequent, and what our research was looking at is in high school, is that optimal? And what we have looked at is one strategy high schools might consider doing more is manual overrides at certain grade levels in high school. It seems to be underutilized.
We're talking with Jared Knowles, a research analyst with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. We're looking at some new research out about English language learners in Wisconsin and when they are or are not moved into the standard English classes. So, Jared, it seems like there are a lot of variables in the manual override process. Is it basically up to, say, an individual teacher to say, wait a second, I really think that this student, you know, has the English, and for that teacher to kind of pursue it on that student's behalf?
One of the things that we really think about is, so our study really took advantage of this reclassification design, and we took kids who were just 1 or 2 points below the cutoff and 1 or 2 points above the cutoff and compared how they did on a number of outcomes afterward. So the only thing really different, I mean, 1 or 2 points can be error in the test, so if they took the test again, they might have been reclassified. So we looked at that, and we saw these disparate outcomes for ACT scores and college enrollment. And one of the things when we talked about those findings within the Department of Public Instruction that we found out is some schools should reclassify students manually, that and they might consider that a strategy. But another strategy is to provide those supports for the ELL students that the students who tested out and became reclassified were getting already. So it's not necessarily the status of reclassification that is really the concern. It's more what is the school doing on either side of that reclassification cutoff to ensure that the students are getting the same access to these post-secondary supports to help them with post-secondary enrollment and things like that.
So when a student gets reclassified and is no longer considered an English language learner but is English language proficient, kind of what doors open for them or what resources are suddenly available to them?
Yeah, so we don't directly observe that in our study, but what we did look at is whether or not it's just that they are getting special supports tailored to the specific assessments that they take or to the specific content knowledge. And it's not simply that. The fact that they are going to college at a higher rate and going to four-year college at a higher rate suggests that they have a differential access to things that the school does that help that, maybe guidance counselors, maybe help with financial aid assistance forms, or things like that. And so one of the things we think is that schools should be more thoughtful, and we should help schools maybe direct them to think more about how the department can support them in providing those services to kids just below the cutoff, or they may consider reclassifying those kids above the cutoff.
It also seems to me that for children who are classified as English language learners, I would assume that the vast majority of them also have parents who probably have have learned English as a second language or maybe don't even speak English yet. And so it seems like that's always a key part of student success is how much support they're getting at home, if they're, you know, if their parents are able to help advocate for them. Is there any effort to also look at resources that are available to parents of English language learners?
I think that's absolutely a strategy that we encourage and that we want schools to pursue. I think what the research implicates is that there's maybe a shift in the way the school as an organization treats these students, and sort of maybe in some cases it's an aha, we've got them to be English. We've been working so hard to get them to be English proficient, and now we can take our foot off the gas a little bit. And instead, what that should probably be is there should be a transition plan from ELL status to non-ELL status that intentionally looks at things like engagement with the parents, things about the student's career plan. And the department has a number of initiatives in place, I think, to help schools think about this moving forward.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing about those in the future. Jared, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jared Knowles is a research analyst at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. He was talking with us about a new study on English language learners in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a New York Times investigation found that NFL research on concussions and fun football is flawed and that head injuries in football might be more frequent than we thought. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.